A Chevron executive just went viral, like completely viral, for telling an entire nation of furious, you know, economically stretched commuters that the secret to beating high gas prices is to simply, well, drive less.
It is, I mean, it's just a stunning bit of corporate messaging. It completely ignores the structural reality of the modern American economy.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to today's Social Pulse Deep Dive. We are bypassing the formal sanitized news broadcast today and tapping directly into what the internet is actually saying, feeling, and furiously debating right now.
Right.
Because we are tracking the raw sentiment across social communities to figure out what is genuinely hitting a nerve with you, the listener.
And if you look closely at the pulse of these communities today, there is a massive overarching theme emerging. We're witnessing what I'd call a real-time collapse of reliance.
Ooh, collapse of reliance. I like that.
Yeah. And we are going to trace this phenomenon, starting from the fury of everyday commuters to a massive geopolitical pivot happening in the Middle East, down to the localized macro realities in South Africa.
Mm. And then into a pretty brutal brand reputation war in aviation.
Exactly. And finally, into a very cold reality check happening in the AI sector.
Let's start with that Chevron executive, Andy Walz, because the reaction on the Reconomy subreddit was just explosive.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. So when he suggested consumers just drive less to offset fuel costs, the community didn't just disagree. They viewed it as outright gaslighting.
Right. Because of the context.
Exactly. Users were pointing out the glaring hypocrisy of corporate America aggressively pushing these return to office mandates, right? Forcing people back into 2-hour daily commutes. And then the oil industry blames those same people for consuming too much gas.
It's wild. The frustration stems from a fundamental misunderstanding of inelastic demand.
Wait, inelastic demand? Break that down a bit for the audience.
Sure. So the advice to drive less implies that the morning commute is a discretionary luxury, like going to the movies or out to dinner.
Like you can just choose not to do it.
Exactly. But for the vast majority of people, the car is essential, non-negotiable infrastructure. Decades of zoning laws have purposely separated affordable housing from commercial centers.
Oh, right. You literally can't live where you work.
Right. And there is virtually no reliable public transit alternative in most of the country. So consumers are a captive market.
It's like a utility monopoly hiking the price of water by 50% and then, you know, publicly lecturing you for continuing to drink it.
That is exactly how it feels.
And the community sentiment really reflects that feeling of being trapped. People aren't just complaining about their wallets anymore. They're talking about, well, malicious compliance.
Oh, really? Like what?
Well, users were literally joking about canceling their summer vacations just to purposefully tank the oil industry's quarterly profits. Like, let's just not drive at all. See how you like it.
Wow. That shift from passive frustration to a desire for active economic retaliation, I mean, that is a key indicator of systemic exhaustion.
Yeah, people are just done.
They are. When people feel that the legacy infrastructure, whether that's city planning, corporate employers, or the energy sector, is actively working against their survival, they stop looking for compromise.
They just want out.
Exactly. They start looking for ways to opt out entirely.
But, you know, the reality is gas prices aren't just spiking because of domestic corporate greed. If we follow the supply chain backward, the root cause of this immediate fuel squeeze is a massive geopolitical choke point.
Right. The Strait of Hormuz.
Yes. The U.S. and Iran conflict has functionally blockaded the strait. And when I was looking at the geopolitical chatter today on our New Star World and our world news cards, the internet isn't focused on Washington or Tehran at all.
Really? Who are they focused on?
The entire narrative has shifted to Beijing.
Oh, that makes sense. China is capitalizing on this moment with incredible strategic precision.
How so?
Well, the U.S. is currently bogged down in this really complex military and diplomatic standoff.
Right.
And China is aggressively stepping into the void to present itself as the adult in the room.
That is exactly what the viral posts are showing. The details going around right now are fascinating. China is publicly urging the resumption of Hormuz traffic, issuing all these warnings about the global economic and humanitarian risks of keeping the strait closed.
Playing the peacemaker.
Yeah. And you have President Xi actively seeking cooperation with Spain to oppose what he called the law of the jungle in international relations.
Wow, law of the jungle. That's pointed.
It is. And concurrently, the data just hit the Rindia subreddit showing that China has officially surpassed the U.S. as India's largest trading partner.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, carrying a staggering $112 billion trade gap.
That $112 billion figure, I mean, that is the linchpin right there.
Why is that specific number so important?
Because it demonstrates that despite massive regional border tensions and, you know, political friction between India and China, economic gravity always wins.
Money talks.
Exactly. China is cementing its position as the indispensable factory floor of the world. By stepping up and preaching the stability of global supply chains, they are wooing European allies and Asian partners with pure economic pragmatism.
But let me throw a theory at you, because the internet is highly skeptical of this whole peacemaker framing.
Oh, of course they are.
Yeah, because China's entire manufacturing base requires imported energy. A massive portion of their oil flows right through the Strait of Hormuz.
Right, it's their lifeline.
Exactly. So people are saying this isn't some altruistic diplomatic mission. It's a desperate attempt to keep their own industrial engines running before their domestic economy stalls out.
Well, yeah, that is the geopolitical reality. China's economy is highly vulnerable to energy shocks.
Mm.
But the brilliance of their current strategy is how they are framing that vulnerability.
Turning a weakness into a PR win.
Spot on. They are taking their own necessity for cheap oil and packaging it as a defense of global free trade.
Yeah.
For international leaders watching this unfold, China is offering a narrative of reliability and economic continuity. Meanwhile, they're painting the U.S. blockade as a destabilizing force that is, you know, punishing the rest of the world.
And when those global supply chains choke, the pain doesn't hit everyone equally. The emerging markets take the brunt of it almost immediately.
Oh, absolutely. The ripple effects are instant.
Right. And I want to bring this down to the local level, because if you look at a community like you down south, which represents South Africa, you see exactly what happens when imported fuel inflation collides with a localized macro environment that is already under immense pressure.
For a developing economy, imported inflation acts like a regressive tax on the entire population.
Right. It just drains everything.
It drives up the cost of delivering staple foods. It spikes the cost of running backup generators for businesses. I mean, it just creates a highly, highly stressed consumer base.
And that stress is resulting in some incredibly raw, visceral community debates right now. There was a viral story tearing through the subreddit about an 82-year-old man who was stabbed in the leg with a screwdriver while he was sleeping.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he was targeted for petty theft. And it fractured the community into two very distinct survival camps. One side was fiercely advocating for arming yourself at all times.
Basically arguing that the state has failed and you are your own first responder.
Exactly. But the other side, the counter-argument, is usually that introducing firearms into a volatile home invasion scenario, like pulling a weapon on multiple armed attackers in the dark.
Right, that often turns a robbery into a fatality.
Yes, exactly. It's a debate born purely out of institutional failure. But what caught my eye was how this narrative of localized state failure suddenly intersected with the global picture.
How so?
Well, someone who was pushing back on the idea of emigrating, you know, leaving South Africa to escape the crime, they chimed in to say they had just been violently mugged in South London.
Oh, well, in the UK.
Yeah. And the UK police were completely unresponsive and unhelpful. And it created this massive realization in the thread that the breakdown of local security and institutional trust isn't just a South African problem.
Right. The grass is greener. Narrative just evaporated.
Exactly. Poof. Gone.
That is a profound psychological shift for a community. I mean, if you are a South African business leader or a citizen, you are navigating volatile currency, imported fuel inflation driven by a blockade thousands of miles away, and a breakdown in local policing.
It's overwhelming.
It is.
Yeah.
But when you realize that moving to a so-called developed nation might not actually solve the institutional failure problem, it forces a hyper-localization of resilience.
Meaning you just have to fix it yourself where you are.
Yes. You stop waiting for the macro environment to stabilize. You figure out how to operate independently within the chaos.
Which perfectly explains the other side of the South African internet. You hop over to South Africa and it's just flooded with these breathtaking high-definition drone shots of Magwa Falls and the coastline.
It is a stunningly beautiful country.
It really is. The emotional attachment to the country's raw potential is so fierce. People don't want to leave. They just want infrastructure that works.
Right.
And that demand for reliable physical infrastructure brings us to a completely different sector that is currently, well, bleeding public trust.
The aviation industry.
Yes.
The shift in public perception regarding commercial aviation over the past few months is unprecedented. I mean, we have moved from apathy to active consumer filtering.
The conversation on social media is a brutal, relentless brand reputation bloodbath for Boeing right now, and it's playing out in the strangest corners of the internet.
Oh, I've seen some of this, but where did you find it?
Okay, I found a viral post on R1200H Jerky.
Wait, what is that?
It's a satirical dieting and calorie counting community.
A dieting subreddit is talking about Boeing.
Yes. The post simply read, "Have you eaten a Boeing? It's less calories than an Airbus."
Oh, no.
And the punchline the community immediately ran with was, "Yeah, because the parts keep falling off mid-flight."
Oh, that is brutal.
It gets worse. Another user threw in that the Boeing Starliner space capsule is only 7 million calories.
I mean, when you have lost the satirical dieting subreddits, the brand crisis has transcended news cycles.
Yeah.
It has literally become ingrained in cultural folklore.
It's everywhere. Over in the hardcore flight simulation community, our flight sim, they held a massive virtual aviation event on the IVAO network. It was Team Airbus versus Team Boeing.
Let me guess how that went.
Team Airbus absolutely dominated in participation and enthusiasm. The gaming community is obsessing over highly detailed Airbus models, like the Tolis A340.
Right.
Even in mobile gaming on our Sky Cards, players are hyped to collect niche rotorcraft like the Sikorsky S97 Raider, while the legacy American fixed-wing brands are just the butt of the joke.
Some executives might dismiss that is just meme culture, you know, gamers having fun. But it represents a fundamental pipeline shift in consumer preference.
Yeah, the sentiment is real.
It's very real. For decades, airline executives treated aircraft as interchangeable metal tubes. The assumption was that the flying public book based solely on ticket price and schedule, completely blind to the manufacturer.
This feels exactly like the computing market shift in the late 2010s.
Oh, the Intel versus AMD battle.
Yes. For years, consumers just bought whatever PC had an Intel Inside sticker on it. But after a string of technical stagnation from Intel, tech enthusiasts started heavily favoring AMD processors.
Right, and it bled into the mainstream.
Exactly. Suddenly, regular consumers were actively checking the spec sheets before buying a laptop to make sure it had an AMD chip.
That is the perfect analogy. And for aviation, the stakes are exponentially higher. If a significant percentage of business travelers and families start actively using the aircraft filter on booking sites to avoid specific models, airline purchasing executives notice immediately.
Yeah, because they can't afford to ignore it.
An airline operates on razor-thin margins. They cannot afford to fly half-empty planes just because the public is wary of the hardware. This relentless meme culture is actively shaping multi-billion-dollar fleet purchasing decisions for the next decade.
So if legacy infrastructure like physical aviation is failing and global supply chains are choking, businesses are desperately looking for a silver bullet to protect their margin.
And right now, the corporate world believes that silver bullet is artificial intelligence.
But the tech crowds on Reddit are calling out a massive discrepancy between mainstream AI marketing and actual deployable production value.
The tension between the glossy venture capital narrative of AI and the gritty reality of enterprise implementation is it's reaching a breaking point.
Let's look at the controversy on London. OpenAI just got glowing press coverage for announcing their first permanent London office.
Right, a big expansion.
Well, the local tech community saw it as a deliberate PR smokescreen.
A smokescreen for what?
They pointed out that this office announcement dropped right after OpenAI halted their massive UK Stargate data center project.
Oh, wow. I missed that timing.
Yeah, and that cancellation sparked a fiery debate about the fundamental underlying economics of the entire AI industry.
The core of that debate centers on whether training these massive language models is a capital expenditure, you know, CapEx, or an operating expense, OpEx.
And does that distinction really matter that much?
It alters the entire financial future of the sector.
Okay, I want to make sure we get this right for the audience. So if training an AI is CapEx, it means you spend billions to build the model once, like building a factory, right?
Right.
And then you just print money by selling access to it for years.
That's the dream, yeah.
But the Reddit community is arguing that AI models degrade, they get leapfrogged by competitors, and they become functionally obsolete every 6 to 8 months.
Exactly. Meaning you have to spend billions to rebuild the factory from scratch twice a year just to stay relevant.
Which reclassifies that massive spend as an operating expense.
Yes. It's no longer a one-time investment. It's a crippling utility bill required just to keep the lights on.
Wow. A multi-billion dollar utility bill.
If the continuous training of frontier models is an OpEx, then the margin structure of these AI companies collapses. They stop looking like high-margin software businesses and start looking like low-margin, capital-intensive infrastructure plays.
That completely shatters the venture capital math that assumes eventual infinite profitability,
It does.
which actually explains the pivot we are seeing in the agent war on OpenAI.
The agent war.
Yeah. The community is openly mocking the highly supervised, curated keynote demos where an AI cautiously books a flight or, orders
Oh,
groceries.
right, the stage demos.
The developers in the trenches are saying, we are miles past this. A user posted about running an open source framework called OpenClaw, which is also known as Run Lobster.
Run Lobster. Gotta love open source naming.
Right, but it deploys real autonomous background agents. While the user sleeps, this open source agent is triaging their inbox, negotiating calendar invites, and replying to Slack threads with persistent memory.
And native commercial tools from companies like OpenAI struggle with those persistent, unsupervised tasks. Their agents often time out or require a human in the loop to confirm actions.
Exactly, which is why the community found it so validating when OpenAI literally acquired OpenClaw and hired its creator, Peter Steinberger.
Oh, they bought it.
They bought it. It's an admission that the era of the generic web browser chatbot is dead. The tech community doesn't want a conversational partner. They want a silent, autonomous worker.
Right.
But while everyone was focused on booking flights and scheduling meetings, there was a much quieter, far more consequential drop regarding where the truly high-end AI market is heading.
Yes, we are seeing the beginning of the great cyber pivot.
Tell me about that.
OpenAI quietly rolled out a new model variant called GPT 5.4 Cyber, granting access only to a limited, verified group of researchers and enterprise security vendors.
So not for the public.
No, this was a targeted strike against Anthropic, who recently released their own highly capable Claude Mythos model.
Okay, so what makes a cyber model different from the standard ChatGPT that, like, a college student uses to write an essay?
They have stripped away the safety guardrails that normally prevent the AI from interacting with malicious code.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, specifically enabling defensive use cases like binary reverse engineering.
Wait, binary reverse engineering, meaning the AI doesn't need the clean, readable source code. It can look at the compiled, scrambled ones and zeros of a mysterious piece of software and figure out what it's trying to do.
Precisely. Normally, to catch a virus, cybersecurity software looks for a known digital signature, basically a threat it has seen before.
Like a wanted poster.
Exactly. But binary reverse engineering allows this AI to pull apart an unrecognized compiled application piece by piece to understand its intent.
That's insane.
It can hunt for zero-day vulnerabilities or embedded malware that has never been documented. The tech giants have realized that selling $20 subscriptions to consumers will never cover those massive OpEx server costs we discussed earlier.
So the real money is in enterprise survival.
Yes, the future valuation of these AI companies relies on them becoming the digital immune system for global corporations. They are building models with strict verification and controlled interfaces that act as automated security operation centers.
Which brings us really to the core thesis of everything we've looked at today.
The collapse of reliance.
Yes. From the commuter trapped by zoning laws, to the geopolitical maneuvering around the Strait of Hormuz, to the raw survival debates in South Africa, to the public rejection of Boeing, and now the pivot toward autonomous defensive AI.
It is all driven by that same collapse of reliance. People and businesses are collectively realizing that they can no longer outsource their trust to legacy systems.
The systems are failing.
They are. The global supply chain cannot guarantee cheap energy. Local institutions are failing to provide basic security. Decades-old blue-chip brands are failing to guarantee safety. And mainstream consumer tech is failing to provide actual operational utility.
So when the macro systems fail, you are forced to build micro resilience.
Exactly.
You see it in the Reddit communities actively building their own open source AI agents rather than waiting for a corporate rollout. You see it in the intense debates about localized physical security. People are aggressively seeking autonomy because the systems they were told to rely on are buckling under the pressure.
And that search for autonomy is going to dictate the next decade of consumer behavior, political alignment, and technological investment.
Well, a huge thank you to everyone for joining us on this edition of the Social Pulse Deep Dive. It leaves you with a pretty heavy question to consider for your own life and your own business. Where are you blindly outsourcing your trust right now?
And what exactly is your plan when that system finally times out?
Definitely something to mull over. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.